Busy show on Tuesday, January 28th. Anthony Papa returned to the program to talk about the latest developments in the Fotis Doulos case as Doulos attempted to commit suicide before possibly being remanded back to jail in connection with the disappearance and alleged murder of his estranged wife, Jennifer Farber. Anthony Papa lecturing on policing and the law at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Our old buddy Len Susio, former Republican state senator from Meriden, stopped by with more news on the petroleum receipts tax, and also somebody else who was sprung from jail early on the early release program and went on to reoffend. We talked to Scott Appleby. He's the Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security for the city, and Bridgeport's City Council President, ID Nieves. Both Ms. Nieves and Mr. Appleby talked about reaction and how the city responded to the shootout Monday afternoon at the Golden Hill Courthouse. Anthony Papa joins us right now on WICC. Anthony, how are you? Thanks for calling back. We appreciate it.
Good, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad. Well, you probably heard what a lot of us have heard. There are rumors that Fotis Doulos offed himself, or he may have a pulse. He was due for a bond hearing later today in which the judge may have sent him back to jail. You know, from a police officer's point of view and with your legal background, Anthony, what in your, I know you can't comment on this case specifically, but in your past as a New York City police officer, what can officers do now and prosecutors to Michelle Traconis to maybe get her to say, okay, here's what really happened, if she knows any more info?
Well, you know, it's all up to the prosecutor. You got to remember, if Traconis was involved in this, he has expired, it's going to be her word against nobody, because there's nobody to counter what she says at this point. I'm sure they would love to hear from her and have her come clean at this point, but it is a difficult situation. You know, hopefully this piece of garbage left some sort of a note or something to, you know, for closure for the family and closure for the police. But we just don't know yet, but hopefully he has.
Now, are the prosecutors, Anthony, in this case, are they liable to go to her and say, okay, he's gone. Okay, so it's you and this other attorney, Kent Mawinney. The Mawinney thing is another strange part of the case. Do they go to her and say, listen, Michelle, you're in trouble anyway, but we can make things a little easier for you? Is that the kind of thing that plays out here or not, Anthony?
Oh, sure. Definitely. They could definitely do that. And it also depends on, you know, what kind of cards they're holding and what they know. But, that would be in her best interest if they do that. But again, they have to be a little suspicious and a little cautious with her, because it's her word against nobody else's at this point. It's just him and her and maybe nobody else.
And also there is, I would guess, Anthony, the point that I guess there's a possibility that she might not know, as far-fetched as that is, she might not know what he actually did with the body, I mean, or where he buried it, or if he dismembered it. There's always that possibility, isn't there?
Yeah, of course there's that possibility. I mean, we could go back to the original speculation that he either flew it to Greece or dumped it in the Atlantic or had it chopped up, and she might not know, but she probably has some indication, because she was involved with disposing of those garbage bags. So I'm sure she knows more than she's letting us know. You know, the whole situation is just horrible, and
yeah.
Hopefully he'll put some closure to this. And we had a similar situation yesterday that occurred in Sunday, which occurred in New Jersey, where young girl, 25, was missing, and they knew that the boyfriend did it, and the police didn't release the information. He killed himself. They didn't release the information that he admitted that he did it in the suicide note, because he did not tell them where he disposed of the body. So they wanted to find the body. They found the body on Route 9, and then they released that information. So although there was some disclosure, there was some closure for the family that he did do it and he admitted to doing it, he didn't he wasn't fully cooperative with them by letting them know where the body was.
So
you never know with this Fotis.
So maybe there is a chance, you're saying, and obviously the cops are doing this, Anthony, maybe there is a chance that, you know, they've taken him to the hospital, obviously, whether he survives or not, but would you say they're probably combing his place right now, mm-hmm. looking for maybe a note?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure that's one of the first things they did after they got the body out. Absolutely. That's very important for the investigation. And they would certainly, and even if they're not, they've secured the area and they'll be getting the warrant to go in and look for the for a note or some kind of indication. Sure. And again, we don't know. We don't know what his condition is. But I haven't even heard. I was actually in class when you called me originally, and I hadn't. I haven't heard what the means of his attempted suicide were.
Well, it looks like carbon monoxide. It looks like he tried to CO2 himself, yeah, in the home. So, anyway, Anthony, thank you. We appreciate your perspective on this case as far as we've been going. He's a lawyer. He's now a professor of criminal justice at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, former New York City cop and detective, Anthony Papa. Anthony, be good. Thanks. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thanks. Thank appreciate it. Well, folks, there you go. Senator Len Susio. Len, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm just doing wonderful, Paul. How
That's
about
good.
Yourself?
Wonderful is. I don't know if I'm at the wonderful level today, Len, but I'll try to get there by 6 o'clock. How's that?
Well, I have a bunch of little grandchildren running around, so I've been having fun with them.
Oh, Grandpa!
My attitude about a lot of things.
Oh boy, Poppy better be good today. Hey, he's on the radio. Hey, listen, Len. We know you have some info about the petroleum tax here, but before that, I want to start with you today. You had posted something on Facebook. You sent me a notice the other day that apparently our early release program, the Connecticut judicial system, has struck again with a violent offender. What's going on with that?
Yes, they arrested a criminal in Hartford. He had committed the first murder of the year in Hartford, and he had been incarcerated in the prisons of Connecticut and got out early under early release. Now, he would have been out anyways, but the point is that the system, which rewards these guys, gives them days and weeks and months and years off their sentences, is supposed to rehabilitate them so that every time one of these criminals returns to a life of violent crime, it's proof that the system is not doing what it's supposed to do. And we're going to be getting more updated data in a few more weeks from the DOC. But the last data I saw, for example, over 1,000 rapists had been let loose out of Connecticut prisons early. And in these days of the Me Too movement, I would think that the female legislators up at the Capitol would be up in arms about that. And they'd be leading the charge to take things like sexual assault out of being qualified to get out for criminals guilty of sexual assault. To be let loose from prison early. There's a high degree of recidivism among that type to begin with. And the victims, the women who have already been sexually assaulted by them, fear for their lives once they're out of prison early because they know it was their testimony that put them behind bars. It's a lifetime sentence for the victims, unfortunately.
And Len, have you gotten an easier go of it now getting some of these numbers from corrections? Because I know for the longest time it was a bit of a struggle for you to get these numbers. Is it getting any easier for you?
Well, I've worked on an arrangement with Senator Sampson's office, and it's always helpful when you have a legislator who's working with you. And so I would say that it's been okay. They've been cooperative, although I don't know if you remember, Paul, but technically what I'm doing with the information they're giving me is something that they are supposed to be doing. They, meaning the Department of Correction, by law, there's a law passed in 2015 that mandated them to disclose this information about criminals released from prison early and the recidivism, what rates they've been and what they're being reincarcerated for, and they don't do that. So it's a real irony that one of the institutions for the enforcement of law is breaking the law and they're doing it now with impunity. No one in the legislature has complained about it. It's just amazing to me, and it's a terrible, tragic irony in some ways because, again, by their refusing to do what they're mandated to do by law to disclose this information to the public, they're covering up the utter complete failure of the law and the failure of our justice system for the victims of these violent criminals in particular.
All right, Len, hang on. We'll get to some tax information you have for us. Straight ahead, former Republican State Senator Len Susio joining us. He's our guy in Hartford that gives us the heads up on certain things regarding criminal justice and some of the budgetary measures that you folks with your busy daily lives might not have a chance to keep up on. More with Len straight ahead. Driving and weather together first. Coming up on the sixes every 10 minutes, this time at 3:36. WICC. Our buddy Len Susio is with us, former Republican state senator from Meriden. Almost said Maryland. Len, I almost gave you pretty good promotion there. I almost sent you about 200 miles south to D.C. Although I don't know whether you'd like to be sitting in today on what's going on from Meriden, Paul, not Maryland. I'm getting punchy early today, Len. But you posted an interesting spreadsheet the other day, Len. I saw on your site on Facebook regarding what, the petroleum tax? Is that what it was?
Yeah, see, a lot of people think, well, the petroleum gross receipts, petroleum gross earnings tax, technically, it's the second tax on gasoline that's levied by the state of Connecticut. I didn't even know it existed until I became a state senator and I was, you know, going through the budget and numbers, and I said, what's this petroleum gross earnings tax? And they said, oh, that's another tax that's on gasoline that's purchased in Connecticut. And so I learned more about it. It's roughly about 22 cents a gallon, but it's based on the percentage of the price of gas. So as the price of gas goes up, this tax goes up. And when that was enacted back in 1981, they put the money right into the general fund. There was no special transportation fund at that point in time. The STF, the Special Transportation Fund, began in 1984, and the legislature directed the gas excise tax, the other tax that everybody is aware of, to go into the Special Transportation Fund, but they did not mandate that the petroleum gross earnings taxes go into the Special Transportation Fund, even though those are taxes on gasoline purchases in Connecticut, and everybody pays them when they buy gas at the pump here. So for the first 17 or 18 years, actually till 1999, every nickel and dime of that money went into the general fund and nothing towards transportation. And then things were getting a little dicey, so they started taking some of it and putting it into the special transportation fund. But I went back and researched the entire history of it, and I found out that they've collected about $5.3 billion worth of this tax, collected again at the pump and paid at the pump by Connecticut consumers of gasoline. And they turned over only about $2.1 billion into the Special Transportation Fund to pay for, you know, the roads and the bridges and maintenance and things like that. So they kept billions of dollars within the general fund that they never put into the Special Transportation Fund. And what really provoked my interest was a very, very misleading press release that was put out by the governor's office about 2 weeks ago, 10 days ago. That's what really got my attention, when they claimed that that basically the general fund had been supporting the Special Transportation Fund by the virtue of them taking billions of dollars out of the general fund and putting it into the Special Transportation Fund to pay for, you know, roads and bridges. They didn't disclose in the article or the piece that they wrote that the billions of dollars were put into the general fund in the first place by the gas taxes, but never taken out. So they made it sound like there wasn't enough gas tax revenue coming in, and the general fund had to come to the rescue, to supplement the gas taxes in the Special Transportation Fund, when the reality is they took billions of dollars of gas tax money and kept it in the general fund.
Yeah.
And then they had to share some of it with the general fund.
Yeah, Len,
I'm
looking at the spreadsheet right now. Now, for example, the fiscal year of 2015, in fact, as you note here, the petroleum gross earnings tax, $379.1 million, I would assume that's what it is, was put in the Special Transportation Fund, and $34.8 million went the general fund. So you're right, they are sending it there, but then the question is, where does it go? What are they doing with it? Len, that's the big question I always get from people who call the show is, can you at least please tell me, what is my money doing? Tell me what I'm paying for.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the year you allude to, that was the first year they realized that they had made a big mistake doing this. So that year, they transferred a big chunk.
I see it.
All right. If you look at the years before that, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're putting a few million here or there into this STF. So, but what they do is by keeping it in the general fund, of course, they use it for their own purposes, whatever they see fit. And it's just like the, you know, the casino money and the, you know, the lottery and everything else. It goes into this big black hole up there, and it gets spent as they need it. And what they're doing now, to be honest with you, Paul, is the unfunded liabilities are just mushrooming. They're just exploding in terms of what's on the state's liability side. And so they're desperate for more money because they're not only exploding now, they're going to continue these expenses. These unfunded liabilities are going to just blow the whole budget apart over the next few years. They're just, I mean, increasing at a phenomenal rate, and the revenues that we're collecting can't keep up with it. So they're desperate for other sources of revenue to supplement whatever is in the general fund because they've got these enormous liabilities. I saw an estimate done by J.P. Morgan Chase Asset Management back about 2 or 3 years ago, and they said these liabilities are so big that that it'll take 35 or 38 cents of every tax dollar collected in Connecticut for the next 30 years to pay for it. So think about that, Paul. If you had a mortgage on your house and you had a double the size of that mortgage, you'd be underwater, right?
Yeah.
And that's effectively what they're doing. The normal state situation is about 13 cents on every tax dollar goes in something like this. Connecticut's 38 cents is what it's going to have to be. It's almost triple. So the state is on the verge of a financial meltdown, basically. That's why the real story behind the tolls. They know they don't have enough money. And, you know, they stole the money for all those years, and now they're desperate, and the tolls are just a way of relieving some of the pressure on the budget. And what they'll do is, like the governor did this last year, there was money from sales tax that's supposed to go into the special transportation fund. Before it could get to the so-called lockbox, the governor intercepted it, $171 million,
Len,
and just said, it's not going in.
I love that when I hear, well, we didn't take it out, we intercepted it. I sit back and I scratch my head. And every time I hear that, I just have to chuckle. Only at the state capitol, with all due respect, because I know you spent years there, but only at the state capitol do we not steal stuff. We intercept it before it gets in the till. And now your old buddy and mine, Martin Looney, is saying, well, we might have a public hearing on tolls without the public there. Isn't that a good one, huh?
Yeah. I always use a metaphor. It's like the gang that robs a stagecoach on the way to the bank, and they take all the money out of the stagecoach, and then they put a few dollars in the bank, and then when they get arrested, they say, you can't arrest us. We didn't rob the bank. We deposited money in the bank.
Oh, man.
The stagecoach before it got to the bank.
Unreal.
That's what's going on here. And by the way, there's so much, by the way, in this draft bill they got. They're going back on their word. They're forming a transportation policy council, which is going to make all the decisions about the rates, the toll rates. And remember, that was a big argument, like the legislator is going to be the one responsible
for
if we ever have to raise the rates, et cetera. Well, right off the bat, just in the draft piece of the legislation, they've got the special transportation council in there. And they're the ones who are going to, this unelected group of bureaucrats are going to make the decision about what the toll rates are going to be. So, you know, but it's just, I could get into this for the next hour in a lot of detail with you. Put you to sleep.
No, I'm glad you bring this stuff up because it's just mind-boggling, and I want people to look at this spreadsheet. I'll see what I can do to post it around. You know, fiscal year 06, just $43 million, for example, of the petroleum receipts tax went into actually fixing roads and bridges. $212 million went into the general fund. Mind-boggling. Len Susio, as always, it is a pleasure, sir.
Can I
Thanks.
Something really quick?
Yeah.
Really quick. I got a complaint from a legislator saying, you're exposing all this stuff. You're making people distrust government. I said, yeah, that's exactly
the come
point.
On. Are you serious?
I'm not kidding. I'm serious.
Is it I'm not asking you to say who it was. Is it a name that we would recognize?
Well, it's a legislator. It's not down in your neck of the woods. It's up in the Hartford area.
Okay.
But he posted it on Facebook, so if you look diligently enough, okay, you'll find it.
Thanks. Thanks, Len. Go play with the grandkids. Thanks.
All right. You take care, Paul.
Thanks, Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Liz joins us, returning to the show. She is the president of the Bridgeport City Council. Heidi, thanks for calling back. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, in the little more than 24 hours since this all happened yesterday, Heidi, in front of the Golden Hill Courthouse, what have your thoughts been from the time you first heard about what was going on until the news conference today? Now that you've had a chance to sit back and think about it, what's on your mind here?
Well, speaking for myself, and as the council president, the thing that has been resonating in my mind is what plan is it that we need to have in place as a city and as a municipality to ensure the safety of our youth? And it's about bringing all of the entities to the table, the fire, the police department, the Board of Education, service providers in the community, our local elected or state elected officials. And it's about having a real conversation of an action plan that can be rolled out with an effective end result. Now, I know we talk about these are the things we have in place, but there seems to be a disconnect with all of the services that we have. And we need to create a straight line of dots of where everyone should be at, who's doing what at the table. And that's one of the things that I've talked to the mayor about and Superintendent Testani about when we talk about a clear line of defining what is the need, how do we meet these needs, and who needs to be at the table. And what happened at the courthouse only amplifies the need to have that conversation and to create that strategic plan for our youth at risk. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, ID, it must be frustrating for you, for the mayor, for the council members, for the education corps in this city, to at least some people not be able to get through to some of these young people that, hey, some mode of emotion that you act on foolishly with a firearm because of a turf dispute or a gang dispute, that's a decision that could conceivably ruin your life. But it's so tough to get through to some of these people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that is something that I mentioned to the Connecticut Post reporter yesterday when I was speaking with him. I was letting him know that, unfortunately, the first things that get cut are social service programs. And the thing that is lacking in our community is those type of programs that allow for conflict resolution. And when we, you know, everybody is fighting for education dollars. Everyone wants public safety dollars because those are the two biggest items that they want the council and the administration always to address. But when we forget about the other counterpart of the need of meeting the need of a child who needs services and parents who need those supportive services, that is where we lose, in my experience, working in the school and working in the community, we lose our youth to other sources, right? And the frustration that I feel as an elected is that I wish we could continually fund these types of programs with community policing, creating better relationships with elected officials and families and meeting those needs that they need in regards to their child's social-emotional development.
And also, Heidi, as I mentioned to the mayor and we agreed on, it's frustrating because I've seen this doing shows here and having worked also in Bridgeport and in New Haven. Every mayor, every municipal person I've ever talked to talks to me about the frustration they have because they know that 98% of the people in any good-sized city in this state or in this country are good, hardworking people. They want to go about their lives. They want to educate their kids, be able to sit outside at night in the summer on a warm night and enjoy themselves. But there's always seems to be, ID, there's this core that for some reason is just, as you say, susceptible to all these other forces, and there's just this ripple effect from a relatively small amount of people.
You're right. It's usually a small amount of people, and it's just getting the resources that those individuals need. And sometimes it's just a simple resource that they need, a family needs, a mother, a single mom needs. And when we have those gaps, that is where the ripple effect gets a little larger, because when you don't have two parents at home, when your mom has to work two jobs because she has to afford to pay the rent, all of those things compound the situations that we end up with. So as a person, I like to sit on my front porch in the summer, and I have real issue with quality of life issues that impact my neighborhood and my community all of the time, and that of the whole city. And those are the small compounded issues that we have when there's a small core group who, you know, it traditionally happens like with a cycle. Every 5 to 10 years, we have these like outbursts of crime, of resurgence of gang activity. When laws change, how it impacts all of our quality of life. And right now, we're at that stage where now our youngest youth offenders are just sent home to their parents, and we don't have the resources for those parents to get the support that they need to stop that little cluster that's impacting quality of life issues. Mm. And those quality of life issues, excuse me?
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. You go ahead. I'm sorry.
Those quality of life issues are such as conflict resolution, the ability to find an after-school program, and then they turn to gangs, they turn to whatever is the easiest fix to fill that gap that they need. And I feel that right now, that's where we are as a city. We need to fill those gaps of how do we get the families to the services that they need? How do we support parents of children who are struggling educationally, socially, and emotionally? And all of those three things are the, if you go back and look at what happened to these youth in school, what was going on with them, and we always find that there was a service that they missed out on that they needed, and the parent didn't have accessibility to it. And it impacts our quality of life as a community.
Bridgeport City Council President ID Nieves. ID, thanks for taking the time this afternoon. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, bye-bye. To talk a little about the aftermath of the crazy hours we had yesterday, the shooting outside the courthouse in Bridgeport on the Golden Hill Avenue, is Scott Appleby. He is, of course, the Director of Emergency Management for the City of Bridgeport. Scott, Paul here on WICC. How are you?
Paul, I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Thanks for stopping by. We know it's been a crazy few hours. We know, Scott, first of all, I believe there was a gathering today of city officials to kind of address the progress on this. Take us through that. What was discussed earlier today, Scott?
Well, the mayor held a press conference just to indicate that, you know, the city is coming together collaboratively with various state, nonprofit, our city council members, and the various youth agencies to try to get a handle on these issues. I mean, this is not tolerated here in the city of Bridgeport. This is not something that, you know, any individual should be doing within the city of Bridgeport. I mean, this is not how we live our lives, right? So the mayor, you know, with his leadership and has taken a very aggressive role in to ensure that we are developing strategies that could minimize any potential issues that we may have in the future, as well as providing opportunities for our youth and reaching out to the youth to explain to them that, you know, we're here and, you know, we're here to help you, you know, to try to get a better sense of where your life, you know, can go in a positive direction.
Yeah, Scott, I mean, that's got to be, and I said this with the mayor yesterday, Scott, you know, it's got to be, I think, the toughest thing. I mean, it's easy to arrest people. Once you know who they are, you can go grab them. You know, you throw handcuffs on people, you throw them in jail. But to me, Scott, the tough part is getting through to some of these young folks, these youth, saying, listen, you better think twice before you pull a gun out to settle some petty dispute, because for all intents and purposes, your productive life could be over.
Well, I mean, you know, you're right. I mean, I think, you know, everybody plays a role in this. I mean, everybody in society plays a role in this. And, you know, the parents, it begins with parents. You know, you know, if you're having difficulties reaching your child, we have resources. We could be there to help you. There's areas of, you know, the schools and teachers and then counselors. And, you know, I know there, even our Bridgeport Police Department, I know there's folks out there that want to see a positive change in every youth's life. You know, we never want to see these tragic incidents occurring. It's the last thing. And as a parent, you know, you never want to see that. So, you know, we're trying to reach them as best we could to know that there's other avenues than what you feel your life has become. And we get it. You know, there's other social economic issues that play a role in all this. We understand that. So let's help. Let's all come together and try to figure this out.
Scott, let's talk about the response yesterday. It was really an interagency response. Bridgeport PD, the state. I know Trumbull helped out. Take us through that. The shots ring out about 12 yesterday afternoon, right around lunchtime. What happened on the first reports of the shots?
So, Paul, I mean, this goes back to, you know, the effective response goes back to what we have been doing collaboratively is the training that we go through. Unfortunately, we go through extensive training as it relates to, you know, active aggressors, active shooters, mass casualty incidents, you name it. The worst case scenarios. The agencies, you're right. I mean, Bridgeport PD at 12:15, when the Bridgeport, you know, Emergency Communications Center, the 911 operators received that call that there were shots fired outside. I mean, within seconds, you had officers running outside of headquarters. You had judicial marshals rendering aid to those that were injured. You had state police. You had, you know, AMR. You had all these agencies immediately, you know, going into their training mode and what we practice all the time, and responded there within seconds and within minutes, potentially saving four lives, right? And in addition to that, it just goes to show that, you know, we don't let our guards down. We practice, we train for the worst case, the what ifs. And those agencies that you talked about, you know, all came together like we've been training, and we were pretty good at minimizing any extensive harm, keeping that area safe, and minimizing any other loss of lives.
And the police chief yesterday on the show here, Scott, he said, look, you guys were kind of on alert because of what happened on the weekend. There might be some retribution. The chief said that there really was no plan by one side to go look for the other side. As I understand it, Scott, he said these people in the SUV just rolled up on these guys, recognized him, and opened fire. And I said on my show yesterday, Scott, I said, my God, what could have happened if there was two or three senior citizens walking through that area, or a group of school kids? I mean, these scenarios must have been rolling through your heads as well.
You know, the first thing you think of is the worst case, active shooter. This is a random act, or this is something worst case. Of course, that always goes through our mind. And, you know, where is the public? You know, is the public involved in this? Are there innocent bystanders? I mean, and again, we can't tolerate this. We have to. We as a society, we as a community, have to come together and say we don't want this. If you see something, you know, it's the cliche, right? See something, you say something, you let us know. You know, let our officers, let our first responders do their job, and hopefully we minimize any potential, you know, worst case scenario in the future. You can't fathom it. It's everybody's nightmare. It's everybody's you know, sense of, you know, the worst case. And we practice, we train, we run through scenarios. But quite frankly, I think in this case, we need to reach our youth and explain to them we have to have a better way of handling our disputes.
And finally, Scott, you know, you and the police department probably hear this all the time, the reluctance of people, maybe just out of pure fear, Scott, that, you know, they may hear something is happening, or they may see the influence in their neighborhoods, but they don't want to say anything. What would you say to someone right now listening to the show here, you know, on a Tuesday afternoon, saying, well, I hear about this gang stuff going on, but I'm too afraid to go to the cops? What would you say?
Call 203-576-TIPS. That's our TIPS line. It's anonymous. If you have to shoot us a text, email, we don't care. We just want the information so we could stop innocent lives from obviously being, you know, the worst case of being lost.
Mm-hmm. And, Scott, one other thing before we wrap up here. I guess we're going to start seeing, as we did in previous times here, a little more of a state police presence here in the city?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a collaborative effort. I mean, I think, you know, the mayor spelled it out very clear, and the governor right down. We're not tolerating this. And if we have to have all of our resources and all of the law enforcement entities coming together to provide solutions, then that's what we're going to do. We're not going to sit back and allow this to happen. And as the mayor indicated today, and again, I think he's been very knowledgeable and very vocal of the leadership he wants to provide nationwide is, you know, we got to get guns off the streets. We got to, you know, have better ways of individuals of handling disputes. But most importantly, we have to tap into everybody's resources.
Scott Appleby, Bridgeport Director of Emergency Management. Scott, thanks for the time, my friend. I appreciate it.
Paul, anytime. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.